first year was a surprise. When we first set up the trade license, I remember putting in a business plan to say that we would make 100,000 dirhams in a year. I mean, that just seemed like an incredible amount of money. And we made a million.
Some people just leave an indelible impression. Right from the very first conversation, you get a sense that this person right here, they're gonna do great things with their life. I met our first guest very fittingly through social media, and our initial conversations were filled with our naive ideas on how we plan to take over the world, innovate, and leave a mark. Little did we know that everything that now defines our lives happened almost purely by accident. But building a multi-million dirham digital agency at a time when social media didn't have the ubiquity it has today, working with countless global brands and shaping their digital voice, and more recently getting acquired by the largest socially-led creative agency in the world, seems like no accident. So pull up a chair and join the conversation as we chat with Akanksha Goyal, founder of Socialize Agency, who told us the tale of how, out of necessity, not only comes invention, but innovation as well. From Amaya FM, this is Tales of the Trade, and I'm Chirag Desai.
Anyone who knows me and hears this, and well, she's crazy, she drives us crazy, none of it's going to be a surprise to them.
There's so much to talk about the habits of an entrepreneur. The circumstances that contribute to setting someone on their own path. The need to pioneer, the attention to detail, the grit, and even the diligence. From what I remember of Akanksha, she definitely had what one would refer to as eccentricities. You know, the mindset of someone who did things in a slightly peculiar manner. So naturally, I wondered when the earliest sightings of these qualities were, and how they led to the powerhouse she is today.
Mom would say that, you know, in the living room, if the carpet was slightly turned, you know, on the side, I would bend down and fix it because I needed it fixed. When I was in school, because I never wanted to scratch anything out, if I'd written a math problem, because my handwriting was just superbly beautiful, so I would not scratch it. I would actually just write the wrong equation, and then right next to it, I would write the right equation. It was actually a problem. So my teachers would call up my parents and say, she's got to stop doing it. It's why does she not scratch things out? And then my mom tried to explain to the teachers that I don't really scratch things out because it doesn't look good on the paper. When they introduced these white eraser pens, oh my God, that was like an aha moment for me, because I was like, now if I make a spelling mistake, I don't have to write the right spelling next to it. So some of these, you know, neurotic things that have sort of, you know, stayed with me till date, where attention to detail is really important. And you know, I can see right away if a deck font is not consistent. I can see right away if it's font size 15 instead of 16, because 16 is what where we should be. So some of that's remained the same. I was a very hard worker. I always cared deeply about my grades, and I was just one of those children who wanted to be front of the class.
Now, Akanksha grew up in India and then moved to Singapore when she was 14. It was there that she started her professional journey, eventually landing a job as the editor-in-chief of Stuff magazine, what she described as the best job in the world. So what makes a young creative up-and-comer uproot their life and move to put it mildly, a burgeoning market like the Middle East?
When I got offered the position in Dubai, I initially did say no, but, you know, then the financial offer was made slightly better, and then I sort of looked at it in comparison to what I was making in Singapore, and I said, you know, let's just do this. I mean, what do I have to lose? I was young and single and ready for an adventure. Not so much, you know, young and fun anymore, but I thought it'd be good to try something new.
Social media was like a big part of your life already by then, right? And I remember you were doing trainings right from the beginning.
I got involved in, you know, social media. Again, back then it was called Web 2.0 in Singapore. So my professor, Michael Netsley, was actually one of the first to actually teach, you know, social Web 2.0 in a classroom. I organized Asia's first ever pod camp along with him. So that was really where I got exposed to social. And when I came to Dubai, you know, got a job here, this was bang in the middle of the financial crisis. So probably not the best time to have moved to Dubai. The company that I was working with, like most other companies at that point in Dubai, weren't doing so well. While I was doing a few training sessions and such with Murdoch University and Dubai Knowledge Village, it was all moonlighting and it was just a passion. But when I realized that perhaps I could charge money for it. Maybe people will pay for this.
At first sight, Socialize, in its current form, a thriving digital communications agency, over 50 people strong, looks and feels like the result of solid intent and vision. But what we uncovered is that its current iteration started out as what can only be described as a fortunate accident, a result of pure happenstance.
It was an idea that was born on a Thursday night, right after a meeting on Thursday afternoon, when my manager said to me that, look, things are not going well with the company. We may have to give you a salary cut. Weirdly enough, my first thought was, oh my God, that would be a disaster. How would I shop at Harvey Nicks anymore? And how can I help the company make money? Because I would like to get paid my full salary. That was as far as the ambition went, to be completely honest. We started Socialize as a department of the company, you know, got a few projects, you know, through agencies and such. We were doing well, but I think my company, to some extent, didn't fully understand what I was doing. And on top of that, I was very eager to go back to Singapore. So I started applying for jobs in Singapore. I resigned. And luckily for me, no one offered me a job in Singapore because I needed a visa to stay in Dubai. So I decided to just register Socialize as a trade license. Again, no intention to start a business. Didn't know the first thing about it. Everything I know is through listening to people and Googling it. So I got a trade license so I could get a visa. And before I knew it, I stopped applying for jobs in Singapore because I was so distracted with people giving us business and wanting to pay us for something I just enjoyed doing.
So you incorporated Socialize. What was the first year like?
The first year was a surprise. When we first set up the trade license, we needed to submit a business plan. I remember putting in a business plan to say that we would make 100,000 dirhams in a year. I mean, that just seemed like an incredible amount of money. And we made a million. It was me, it was a one-man army with a few interns who offered to come in and, you know, work with us for free. And a few, you know, we had, you know, one or two other employees that we got on board after the first few months. But it was a few of us who were posting content for brands, who were designing posts on PowerPoint, all of that.
So how does a one-woman army and a team of interns go from running this company by the seat of their pants to getting acquired by one of the largest digital agency groups in the world? In June 2018, Socialize was acquired by the reputed VR Social Network, a part of Blue Focus, China's leading marketing services group. It came as no surprise that acquisition was actually on the table from as early as 2010. But the journey from the first time Akanksha considered it to finally biting the bullet, now that's what great entrepreneurial will-they-won't-they stories are made of.
We had the first network that spoke to us and said that they were interested in doing this. I mean, back then it was more about, you know, we'll hire you to sort of run this, you know, sort of start up this digital unit of our network. And since you've got a few people, you know, we'll bring them along, you know. I mean, it was more that. And I actually considered it back then, A, because I just didn't even know what it meant. It just felt like me and everyone on my team was being offered a job. It seemed like it seemed like that was a good thing. But thankfully, I went in for a meeting, and right at the end of that meeting, he said to me, you know, Kansha, probably shouldn't be saying this, but having spoken to you over the last hour, I see a lot of potential here. You're onto something, and you don't even know where you're going. You've got big things ahead of you. Don't do this. Say no. The fact that he said that, I was like, okay. And then I sort of came back and, you know, said no, you know, continued staying friends with the network and such. And then 2 years later, you know, again, sort of came up with another network. And at this point, the MD of the network sent me an email with 10 questions around our business and our P&L and the rest of it. And I naively responded back saying, why should I answer these 10 questions? I mean, you're the one who wants us to join your network, so shouldn't you answer these 10 questions? Did not hear back from him, obviously, for a few weeks till he, you know, called me in for a coffee and said, I don't think you know how this works. And I was like, no. And he said, obviously, it seems like you're not ready. And I said, no, we're not. Why would you want to acquire us right now? I've got so much we need to do with operational excellence and the rest of it. Then I signed up for an executive education course at Harvard on how to take your small business through its growth life cycle, because I was like, I don't know the M of the M&A, you know, so how am I going to have these conversations and take my business where I need to take it? And at the end of that course, I have to say, I understood a little bit better. The biggest learning was, even after you pay thousands of dollars, you don't get the answers. That's what I learned, is that you keep asking the questions and you've got to find the answers on your own. And I came back with the confidence to know that it's not that I know little, very little. It's just a journey that every entrepreneur needs to take.
When you put everything on the line, you get a lot of things right. But the learning is all in the mistakes.
Story not a lot of people know, but one of the first few challenges, I mean, still a challenge, right? One of the first few challenges that we had to deal with is, you know, how do you get paid for the work that you do? And I remember it was the first few months into a relationship with HB, and oh gosh, probably shouldn't even say this. One lady there, I hope she never listened to this, but we had a challenge where we hadn't been paid for a few months. I sent her an email and I said, hey, you know, could you just look into this for us? We haven't been paid for the last few months. And she said, oh, absolutely not a problem. Could you please send us the invoice numbers and I'll get finance to check, you know, why you haven't been paid. Now, I didn't know what an invoice was. So I'd Googled an invoice and I'd seen a template on Google and, you know, they had these numbers on top. I didn't know what that number was. So I would just, every time I created an invoice, I would rewrite that number into 10368, something I'd completely made up. And because I also am quite neurotic and I had an inbox zero policy, I would send an email and delete it and send an email and delete it. So I didn't actually have the invoice numbers because they were completely made up. And I kept rewriting the same file, you know, keeping a clean desktop and keeping a clean email. So when she asked for the invoice numbers, I didn't have anything to give her. And I had to come up with this elaborate story about how our finance system has crashed, because what kind of an idiot doesn't have the invoices? If you could please help us and get your finance to look at it. And she did. I never forgot what an invoice number was after that. You know, those were the type of challenges. I think the challenge was just learning everything on the job, not really knowing what you're getting into, but at the same time wanting to do it and do it to the best of your capability and knowing every time you made a mistake and it just really bothering you when you did, you know?
Especially to someone who can't stand a rug being out of place.
Yes, exactly.
So from not knowing what an invoice was, turning Google into her mentor and savior, Akanksha transformed Socialize into the most coveted digital agency in the Middle East. When we come back, the story of how she pulled that off.
Hi, I'm Shlina, professional organizer and host of the Declutter Me podcast on Emea FM. Each week we bring you a short and sweet episode on how to organize and declutter your physical space, digital life, and even your mental clutter. Look for Declutter Me in your favorite podcast player or visit decluttermeme.com/podcast.
It's like, let me tell you a joke. You ready? Work-life balance.
Welcome back. You're listening to the first episode of Tales of the Trade and the story of Socialize. This episode is produced by Gaia, and original music for the show was composed by Rainer Erlings. Although today getting acquired is perceived as a benchmark for success as a startup, there's also a flip side. How do you take something you've built from scratch, something that is your baby, and leave it in someone else's hands, albeit in this case, some very capable hands? What happened in the lead up to this acquisition?
Over the last few years, we've been doing a lot of world-first things, right? So we did something, you know, with Mercedes-Benz, which is the first of its kind in the world. We went to Cannes, we applied there, just saw what the best of the creative minds in the world look like. And at that point, I thought, you know, I think time has come for us to be playing on a global stage because we're doing well regionally, but obviously our ambition was to try and, you know, as I say, go global. And it's not the type of, yes, we could do it on our own, but we're going to get there a heck of a lot faster if we, you know, do it along with a partner. So this was, I think, around 2016, beginning of 2017, that I first had the thought that maybe it's time for Socialize 2.0, for us to find a partner that's going to be the delta for the agency. It almost felt like finding a partner for Socialize would be more difficult than finding a husband. So we signed on advisors, R&D Ventures, who are based out of Canada, New York. It's like, you know, you don't want to get married without a priest. You know, 8 years of your life, you've built this baby, and if you want to share it with someone, it's a big decision. On one of our meetings, phone calls, they put Blue Focus on the table. And I said, oh my God, Blue Focus, that's very interesting. And the advisor was a little bit surprised, and he said, oh, you know Blue Focus? And I said, yes, of course I know Blue Focus, because I know VR Social was acquired by Blue Focus, and I've been following VR Social's journey ever since we started, because they were the first social agency in the region. You know, that was the only reference point that we had for social. In fact, you know, back then when we still used Google Alerts, you know, it was a different world. And I had Google Alerts set up for Robin Grant and Nathan McDonald, who are the founders of VR Social. So, you know, the moment the name came up, I said, oh, well, that would be interesting. Would they be keen to do this? And advisors were like, well, you know, leave it with us and let's have a conversation. And it was really just perfect timing, almost, what's the word? Serendipity?
Serendipity?
Serendipity. turns out that right at the time when, you know, our advisors work with their advisors, they were looking to expand. They were looking to find a partner. And we started the, you know, conversations from there, really. And I met with them about a year back in Cannes for the first time. And, you know, after a few meetings, I knew that they were the right partners for us strategically.
I think it's really interesting, too, because, like, I was looking at some of the, I mean, the way the arrangement is, if I can call it that, right? They get someone in this region, which is great for them. You have a lot of benefit to this, but you get independence and you get to...
Yes, absolutely. It's actually something that one of my advisors said to me, you know, after I had this long chat with her at night, you know, I mean, this is such a personal process. It's not really about the numbers ever. It's about, you know, should I, shouldn't I, who would be right? And she said to me, you know, Kangsha, from everything you're saying, it seems to me that what you're looking for is autonomy with mentorship. And that, and she put it beautifully, right? Autonomy and mentorship. And that's what our partnership with VR Social gives us, is autonomy to keep doing what we're doing in the region. But at the same time, I'm now surrounded by superstars. I'm part of the global board. I get to interact with the MDs of the different offices who in their own right are just superstars. It's nice to be on a global call where you're the one who's not saying anything. And I'm used to not, you know, I like talking, you know, but in, on these calls, I'm the one who's not saying anything because everyone has got such, you know, it's got so much to add, and I'm just not quite sure if I'm there yet. And that has been wonderful because I'm learning from peers, and I think that's something that I've probably missed when you're an island and you're doing things on your own. It's, there's a lot to learn.
So how does it feel?
I had quite a few feelings around the acquisition right before I signed. You know, there was a sense of anxiety, there was a sense of loss, you know, there was potential loss, anticipated loss, there was a sense of excitement, there was a sense of fear. All of that right before I signed. And then the moment I signed, it sort of just became a new reality and nothing's really changed. And I think that probably to me is the biggest sign, or, you know, it's, for me, it's confidence that we picked the right partner because nothing's really changed in the day to day. And now it just seems like all news. Cognitive dissonance has kicked in and, you know, we've done this. So it's this new reality and, you know, things go on.
How did you break the news to the team?
We're quite a close-knit team at Socialize, so things don't remain a secret for too long. Also, you know, being a single owner of a company, you need to have a management team around you that you trust and you can talk to. So when the thought first crossed my mind that maybe time was right for us to find a partner, they knew because I needed to talk to them about it and get their opinion. The wider team, I think probably 6 months before this happened, they knew something was happening.
Having interacted with the Socialize team, there's something distinctive about this assembly of creatives who are all mavericks in their own right. I was very curious how this came to be.
When you're at the bleeding edge of any industry, it's hard to hire talent, I think is why we've ended up with 14 nationalities among like 40, 45 people. We've had to hire internationally because we wanted to bring on people who had experience with social, who understood the potential of digital, and we didn't always find that in the region. No one's ever hired on just a recommendation or an interview. We had assignments. I mean, even back then, I loved putting a test together for everything. You know, in university, I was a teacher's assistant, and research assistant for every course. So I had a test for everything. You would do the test. I would evaluate the answers. If the test was right, then we'd do an interview. Then it was all about the attitude and ultimately hiring nice people, well-read, articulate, curious, opinionated, and outliers, because I felt like I was an outlier, so it was very important for me to hire people who were outliers.
And then how did you handle letting people go?
Well, not so much maybe letting people go. There are two aspects to people, is people leaving and letting people go. The first person who resigned felt like the biggest stab in the heart, in the back, you know. It was so painful. And then the next one is slightly better. And then the next one is slightly better. And then after a while, you just get better at dealing with people leaving. If you're an emotional sensitive person, it is painful when people leave you. And then when it comes to letting people go, again, letting people go is a very hard thing to do. It's something I'm still trying to get better at. It's a lot easier to let people go when there's anger involved. So when there's wrongdoing and there's anger, it's a little bit easier. When it's competency issues, it's very hard, still struggling with it. And hopefully, you know, we get better, because if I don't get better at it, my business suffers. So far, we've probably only let two people go in 8 years, yeah.
If you have to look back, like, at the 8 years, or perhaps, I guess, pre-acquisition now, a mistake you made, you think you wish you'd done better?
So many.
Pick two.
Two. Okay. They're not sort of, you know, moment in time mistakes. Those happen all the time and you learn from them. They're more sort of fundamental things that I would now in hindsight do differently. I'm a Marwadi, you know, and a lot of Marwadis are businessmen, though I don't come from a business family, but it must run in my blood. Marwadis are known to be quite stingy. They manage money well. And I think in hindsight, I probably shouldn't have been such a Maru, which is I ran a tight ship for very long. And what meant is I ran it to margin. It was very important for us to keep certain margin and to be, you know, and it helped us because we've been bootstrapped, self-funded, and we've never had any debt. We've never needed to borrow money because I ran a tight ship in terms of our cash flow and margins. But there's always, you know, cost and revenue are a trade-off. And because I managed the business to the cost, we also didn't invest as much in the business. So we didn't hire a lot of people, or we didn't try and set up new offices and such. And, you know, we probably would have been a lot bigger if I hadn't done that, if I'd probably invested some of the money back in the business or taken a few more risks with the business. Now it's easy to say, hey, you know, I could have done so much more with the money. I didn't know any other way, but I feel like I should have probably taken a few more risks. But, you know, there's two different theories on it. But the other one was just more of a, you know, it's like not knowing what an invoice is, I suppose. And at this point, we were quite big in 2015, 2016 as a business. And I was just monitoring the business on a wrong metric. I was looking at our business based, and this is a very technical thing, but I was monitoring and optimizing my business based on a ratio of billing versus cost, as opposed to net revenue versus cost. Now, what that does is it gives you the wrong picture of the business, because we do a lot of media, which means clients will pay us 100 dirhams, out of which 90 gets paid to a Facebook and a Google. So that's our revenue, and our profit is 5. If I compare 100 to 5, it looks like I'm not doing well. But when I compare 10 to 5, I am doing well. For an entire year, I was comparing 100 to 5, thinking we're not doing well, optimizing our costs, when actually we were doing just fine if I'd been looking at the right numbers. And it took us bringing on a new CFO for me to realize I'd been optimizing the wrong number. You know, we live in this Instagram world now, right? I follow a few entrepreneurs and, you know, agency owners, and they're so inspiring. You know, they put up stories about how, you know, he must run at 5 a.m. and you must achieve these things, and they make it look so simple, right? And they make running a business look so simple. So I don't know what they're doing and how much they know, but it's not been simple for me. It's still not simple. It's hard work. You're looking like an idiot every day. You're making mistakes. You're trying your best. And I think it's just important to put it out there that you make mistakes every day, and it's like hard work.
They say it takes a village, and I wanted to find out what the Kanksha support system was like. When she's done with a long and hard day of being at the helm of this dynamic agency, leading a team of fiercely creative folks, who does she lean on? Who are her confidants? Who are her champions?
No one's ever asked me that, so I've never ever had an opportunity to talk about that, because I'm sure my parents think that I don't say enough thank yous for, you know, having arrived here and how much of a part they played in it. But, you know, as a child, I always knew that I wanted to be rich, when that was something that was very important to me. And when my mom would say to me, learn how to sweep the floor, I would say, no, I'm not going to do it. And she said, you have to do it. If you get married, then, you know, how are you going to know what to do? And I said, Mom, I'm going to have a maid. And she said, reality check. You're not going to have a maid. No one has maids. We grew up, you know, came from a simple family. People didn't have maids. So she said, learn how to cook and sweep. And I just really didn't want to do that. And I kept saying, one day you'll see. And so to the point of, you know, how did my parents react when I first told them that I wanted to do this? I have to say they were incredibly supportive. I don't know if I would have done it if it wasn't for me flying over to Bahrain to see my dad for lunch and telling him, so I have this idea. I was thinking of getting my own trade license, you know, while waiting to go back to Singapore, and maybe trying this out on the side. And he just looked at me, he said, absolutely, you should do it. And I was like, really, I should? And he said, yes, absolutely, you should do it. Do you need anything from me? Do you need, you know, any money? And I was like, no. And he said, well, good, do it. What's the worst that could happen? There's nothing to lose. You're going to be fine. So it was really that, you know, vote of, I don't know if it's confidence, but really the, you know, go take a risk, take, you know, go from living paycheck to paycheck to living adventure to adventure. The fact that they supported it was a big part, played a big part, provided a safety net for me to take that jump. It's important, right?
Of course it is. No, that's why I asked the question as well. Like, it's superbly important because, and it's not necessarily just always parents. I mean, it's everybody around you. It matters, yeah.
Again, not something I talk about a lot, but I'm married to a very patient man, and maybe sometimes underestimate just how much of a role that plays in allowing me to do what I do. I never have to answer any questions about where I am, if I'm client meetings or whatever. There's no competition. He just completely supports what I do, completely gets it. He, you know, allows me to put my career sometimes, you know, before our marriage and relationship. And it's so important to have that, because if I was going back home to someone who was complaining about how I wasn't home enough, or I was coming back late, or that I never have time for anything else, it would be so hard to keep doing what I'm doing.
You met him, I think, after you started Socialize already, right?
Yes, exactly. I remember I met him when I had just been able to pay my dad back the down payment for my car. That was the time I'd made it. Like, it was that day. It was the same day. It was the first time we sort of, you know, went from, oh my God, you know, are we going to make it, to yes, we're on to something. And I met him at that point, and I think that was, you know, thank God, because he already knew what he was getting into, you know. He already knew.
What would you say you're, like, your proudest of?
Not completely losing my sanity.
You haven't lost it yet?
Not completely. No, I mean, I'm here. I'm having this conversation. I mean, come on. I mean, and there are a few little things in there, but I'm, you know, just having this conversation. I haven't gone and, you know, hidden under a blanket, and I don't want to see, you know, anyone ever again. Though, you know, I'm not in touch with most of my friends anymore. So you lose a few things, you know, through the journey. It's impossible to have everything, the business, the, you know, the health, the family, the friends. What am I proudest of? And it's the same thing every day. I'm proudest of the team we've built and put together, you know, this group of people that work beautifully together, doing great work, and we're impacting, you know, impacting their lives, their families, you know, just having built a little bit of a tribe is, I think, what I'm proudest of. Getting these people together, to actually convincing them to want to go on this journey with me. I mean, most of them are people that I would love to have as friends, irrespective of Socialize, you know, even personally. So the fact that some of them are people I learn so much from and inspire me, and I think, I can't believe that they actually come and do this with me. I can't believe they want to work, for example, with me or for me. I'm crazy. But, you know, I think that's what I'm proud of, just bringing this group of people together. Just, like, hope no one we are social, like, listen to this, because they're going to be like, she's, like, so unsure about everything. Like, come on, just get with the plan. You know, be a winner.
It's funny how you think you know someone and then they go and change the world. When you let yourself be defined only by your own ideas, ambitions, dreams, and instinct, you are unstoppable, capable of things that seem intangible to those around you, but undeniably palpable to you. Journeys like Akanksha's are a reminder of this fact. And for me personally, watching and cheering from the sidelines has never been more of a joy. You've been listening to episode 1 of the first season of Tales of the Trade. New episodes are out every 2 weeks. You can follow us on Instagram for more content and behind-the-scenes action. Many more tales to be told, so many stories to be shared. Do pull up a chair and join this conversation. You can subscribe to the show in Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, or wherever you like to listen.